6 in Xilvus, near the bottom of the page, about 3 lines from the bottom, middle of Isir Gimel. We started learning yesterday about how if a person smells food and craves it, then it makes them, it at least causes them great discomfort. It may even be dangerous to their health. And therefore, we said that when you have a waiter who's serving food, you need to give him some of the food ahead of time. Strictly speaking, the Gemara said it's only meat throughout, fat meat throughout the year and wine during the summertime. But then we said that Midas Chassidus is to give the waiter a little bit of each of the foods. And in fact, the best way to do it is to give it to him before the meal. We said that those who do that were Zeicha Tegilui Eliyahu, and those who weren't. So the Gemara continues on this topic of someone smelling food and getting a craving for it, and it being and their health being in danger from it. Amema umazutra v'ravashi haba koyasi apischa debe izgur malka. These three chachamim, Amema, Mazutra, and Ravashi, were sitting by the door of King Izgur. He was a Persian king. In other places, the Gemara calls him Izgadar or Izdagar. So they were sitting in front of Izgur's palace. And then the king's waiter passed by carrying food for the king. Rav Ashi saw that Mazutra's face had turned pale because he'd smelled the food and he had a taiva for it, and now he's, as we were learning before, now his health might be in danger because of it. Shokol ba'etzva'asei, so Rav Ashi put his finger into the food and took a little bit of the juice of it or something, anachle b'pume, and put it into Mazutra's mouth. Now, we actually learn the halacha from this. There is a halacha that comes from this, that Amma mentions that, for example, a person smells food that contains vinegar or other things that are likely to wet a person's appetite and his health is in danger, then you can give him some of it, even if it's non-kosher food, because for pastors, that's what it was over here. King Izgur, a goyish king, is obviously not eating kosher food, especially as we're going to see what kind of food it was, in fact.
The term is a chosoi bulmus, no?
What?
The term is a chosoi bulmus.
A chosoi bulmus is an expression, no. So this wasn't necessarily bulmus. The Gemara doesn't mention that. It's true. There is something in Yuma. It talks about bulmus, which is where a person has a particular life-threatening kind of craving for it. Here, it wasn't necessarily that, but it was still something. He could see that Mazutra's face had turned pale, and he realized that his health might be in danger from it. With that said, though, the fact that he put only a fingertip of it in his mouth, Marsha points out, so that way, in other words, like this, we've talked about before, the point that the Gemara mentions in various places that Hashem protects tzaddikim from eating things that are osur. To how would Mazutra have this happen to him? And the answer is, since it's only a taste, it's not really going into his stomach, so therefore it's not really such a problem. The waiter says to Rav Ashi, what do you think you're doing? I've sad to the Sudas and Amalka. You've ruined the king's food. He's not going to want to eat it after you touched it. And they said to him, Am I tevid hochi? How could you do such a thing? So the king's guards and whatever said, how could you do such a thing? Amalahu, so he sort of Ashi answers them, Man de Ovid Hai, anybody who makes food like this, Hustle a Michael the Malka has anyway ruined the king's food. It's not the food that this guy was carrying is not suitable to be eaten by the king. Amrilei Amai, so they ask Rav Ashi why, what's the matter with it? Amalahui says, Dover Acha Chazoide. I saw Dover Acha in it. Now, Dover Acha can have two meanings. Sometimes it means Chazir, but fine, Izgur is not going to have a problem with that. He's a goy. The other point is, though, that Dover Acha sometimes means saras. And that's what Rashi says over here. I saw that the meat of the schazer had saras. As in fact, Marsha points out that, in fact, the Gemara mentions in Kiddushin that of the 10 measures of saras that came down to the world, 9 of them pigs have. So therefore, so Rashi says, I noticed that on this piece of meat that the pig that it came from was diseased. They checked and they couldn't find any evidence of that. Rav Ashi took the finger of the cook and put it on the particular piece, on one particular piece of the meat. And he says to the guy, did you check that particular part? Sure enough, they checked and they found, sure enough, there was signs on the meat that it had saras. So the Chum asked him, how could you have been soymach on a ness? which can mean, in other words, Poshet, that you couldn't have known, it didn't have Saras before. Apparently you, with your Tzidkus, caused all of a sudden that Saras appeared on it where there wasn't any before. So how could you rely on a Ness? In other words, Marsha points out, after all, yes, Mazutra's life was in danger, but the potential danger to Rav Ashi, had he not been able to prove that the mead had Saras, would have been greater. They would have, Chas v'Shalom, who knows what they would have done to him. So how could you rely on a Ness? The different version of Rashi, Shittim Kubetzis, over here brings a Mahadura Kama of Rashi, that explains, they asked him that the question is a little bit different when they asked him how you're Samech on a Ness, how did you know that you're going to be able to find evidence of Saras over there? Amalahu, he says it wasn't such a Ness. Chazoi, Ruach Tzaras, de Kaporche Ilabe. I actually saw the spirit of Tzaras hovering over Mazutra, and I realized that was because I'd given him a little bit of the juice from this meat, which in turn was from an animal that had Tzaras, and therefore now I saw that such a spirit is hovering over Mazutra, and I put two and two together and realized that in fact this animal had Tzaras. But the point is, we see, in other words, again, that Mazutra, by smelling the food, was seized with a craving, and then his life would have been in danger, and therefore Rav Ashi had to use this extreme measure in order to save him.
So you saw that it had Saras after he gave it to Mazutra?
After he gave it to Mazutra, obviously, yeah.
And in the beginning, he actually risked his life.
Yes.
So he did not know
that. In the beginning, he risked his life, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Incidentally, by the way, Mephoshim point out, it has to be that the waiter didn't notice that he actually gave the food to Mazutra. Otherwise, they would have asked him, well, if you knew it had Saras, what are you giving it to your friend for? By the way, Reb Levi Yitzchak, Rebbe's father, has an interesting explanation about a different story in the Gemara involving the same king. His story about him in Zvachim, where he's called King Izgadar, he's called over there. And Reb Levi has a long, interesting explanation of a story that happened over here. He mentions Derech Agav that he was called Izgur, and he says that if you're the name Izgadar, as he's called over there in Zvachim, is the same gematria as Chazir. Appropriate enough, since we're saying that his food was in fact Chazir. Okay. Another example of a person whose life was there, whose health was in danger because of smelling food that they couldn't have. There was a woman who said to a certain woman, doesn't say whether she was Jewish or not, Minsvasli, will you marry me? No, I don't want to marry you. Also, I see Rimoni, so he came and he went and took pomegranates, poliv ocho kama, and he was cutting open the pomegranates and eating them in front of her. And apparently she couldn't get away. Maybe he had her a prisoner or something, doesn't say. So she's having a craving for it. So she's having a craving, her mouth is watering for it. All the saliva that she was producing that was bothering her, blighted, she was swallowing it. And he still wouldn't give her any. Adizogla, until she became so swollen that she became like translucent. Like when a person's skin is swelled up pathologically, like there's so much water under their skin that like the skin becomes translucent. You can partially see through it. She was very badly bloated from the effect of this. Eventually the woman tells her, if I heal you from this bloating, then will you marry me? She figures she has no choice. She says yes. Again he brought pomegranates, and again he's eating them in front of her. But this time he tells her, the cure is don't swallow the saliva. All the saliva that's bothering you from your mouth watering, tuf shadoi. Spit it out and throw it away and keep on spitting and throwing it away. So she did that. Eventually there came out of her so much saliva, it was something like a green palm leaf, so much saliva and mucus and whatever, they to see us and she was cured. Whether she followed through and married the guy, history doesn't record that detail. What's the point? So obviously the point of the story is again to illustrate how her craving for the food put her health at least at risk. There is actually an interesting nafkamina from this in halacha that the Beis Yosef brings from this little story over here. We know that by chalitza, one of the things the yavama has to do is to spit on the ground in front of the guy, the yoker b'fono. Now, the Gemara mentions, and it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, that preferred, even though the spitting is technically not ma'akiv, nevertheless it is supposed to be done, and it should be that the saliva comes naturally and not as a result of there are certain kinds of foods. The Gemara mentions that cause an increase of saliva, and therefore she shouldn't eat them before the chalitza. Now, the Beis Yosef points out, based on the, now, pomegranates are not on the list over there in the Gemara Yenivamas. However, the Beis Yosef says, based on the story over here, we see that pomegranates have that effect also. Maybe other kinds of food have that effect as well. Therefore, la halacha, better the Yavama shouldn't eat anything for some time before she's going to do the chalitza, and that way you can be sure that the saliva is coming naturally.
I don't understand. How does it prove that the pomegranate is causing the saliva?
She didn't actually eat it, but the point is she had such a craving for it that it caused such a...
Anything could give her a craving.
Maybe, but okay. Well, that's why the Beis Yosef says, look, we don't know exactly what kinds of foods the Gemara there in Yavamas lists two or three foods that can cause this, but you never know what other kinds there might be. That's what I'm saying. So one hayra is a hayra in halacha. Other than that, I mean, we can see from it the kind of thing that can happen. First of all, you can learn from it a health lesson. If, Taka, you have a craving for food and you're not able to eat it, then at least don't swallow the saliva that comes from it. Because we see that she did that, and look what happened. Okay. Okay. So the Mishnah mentions like this. One of the three responsibilities in the Torah that a husband has to his wife is Oinosa, which we learned in Sherek Sus of Oinosa, we said, and in the previous Perek, the Gemara had brought two opinions. Everybody agrees that Oina, that they're having regular times for Tashmish with her are one of his responsibilities. Machlokas Tanoim, whether that's from the word She'ero or the word Oinosa. Whatever the Mishnah points out, that he has a responsibility for that. Now, the Mishnah mentions then that different kinds of workers have different schedules for that, depending basically how often they're home and how strenuously they work and so forth. Rashi mentions in Parshas Vayishlach, you find, for example, you find by the gifts that Yaakov sent Esav, that over there you have Izim Mosayim, the Tiyoshim Esrim, because the Tiyoshim over there don't do work and they have plenty of time for Tashmish as opposed to the Purim and the Gemalim and whatnot, which have less time for it. So here we have a remez to this concept. Well, the Mishnah mentions that Talmidim yotzim l'talmud Torah shaloi b'rishus lamed yom v'chola. Talmidim, people who are going out to learn Torah, they can leave to learn Torah even without the permission of their wives for 30 days. Usually the Mishnah mentions the oina of a talmud chacham would be every Friday night. But here he's allowed to leave even without his wife's permission for a month to learn Torah. So the Gemara asks, b'rishus kama. What about if he does get her permission? How long can he leave for? Well, so what kind of question is that? Tama de boy. As much as she wants. If she agrees that he can be away for a couple of years, then he can be away for a couple of years. What do you mean, how much? So the question is, urcha de milsa kama. Fine, but what's the usual way of doing the thing? What's the derech eretzika way of doing it that he shouldn't be guilty of an aveda for it? Because after all, look, he could convince her, Rashi says, he could convince her to let him stay longer, but after all, when she agrees to such a thing, it may not be willingly. It may be that he convinces her and she's just too embarrassed to argue back. It might be that she didn't realize how hard it would be, etc., v'chola, all kinds of different reasons. So therefore, so what's the amount that he could leave without it being a problem? Omar Rav, chodesh kan v'chodesh v'bayis. So Rav says, 1 month at home, one month here in the Beis Medrash, 1 month at home. So he can go for a month, and then he has to be for a month back home, and he can alternate like that. Shenema, as we find in connection with David HaMelech's officers, in Divrei Yomim, it mentions that David had a system where he had 12 officials, each of whom was responsible, together with the people of his division, were responsible for supplying food and supplies to the royal palace for 1 month during the year. And the Pasuk mentions this person was in charge of 24,000 people who, between all of them, they were going to be working for the king for Chodesh Nisan and the next group of Chodesh Iyar and so forth. So Shenema, and the Pasuk says, L'chol Dvar HaMachlokos, as far as all the matter of these divisions, Habav Ayotzis, the ones that are coming and the ones that are going, chodesh b'chodesh, month by month, l'chol chodshei hashana, throughout all the months of the year. Now, Rashi explains, if you look in the context of the Pasuk, we're saying that each machloka, each group, was only serving David for 1 month out of the 12 months. So where are we getting over here, alternating 1 month in, 1 month out? Rashi says, because what Rav is darshaning from the extra words in the Pasuk, habav ayotzis chodesh b'chodesh. In other words, we understand that there were two things. There were the groups of the 24,000, each one headed by one of David's officials who were responsible for supplying, for working for the king for 1 month. But in addition, there were other groups. In addition, there were other groups who would rotate in and out month by month. So one group would be serving in Nisan, then the next group would take over in Iyar, then the first group would take over in Sivan, and they would switch off like that throughout the year. So Rav says, by the same token, Talmid Chachamim can do the same kind of thing. Marshall also further points out that, it doesn't necessarily mean that the guy has to be able to be 11 months at home, because, I mean, that would be the entire time. Suppose his wife becomes pregnant, that includes the entire pregnancy and the time she gives birth. He doesn't have to be home all that time. So Rav is just saying that he can be away for a month. Then one was saying that he has to be for a month at home means, since the posuk doesn't give a shiur for that, so we would assume it's the same kind of thing. If he's going to be away for 1 month, then we should assume he should be for 1 month at home. That's Rav. Rav Yochanan, I'm a chodesh kan or shnai in the Beis Medrash. Rav Yochanan says it has to be 1 month here in the Beis Medrash, but then he has to be 2 months at home. Shenema, as we find by Shlomo's workers who were quarrying stones and then carrying burdens and all to build the first Beis Mikdash, the pasuk describes chodesh yir, well, particularly the ones who he sent to Levana to chop down trees for wood for the Beis Mikdash. The pasuk describes he had a labor force over there, chodesh yir b'Levana shnayim chadoshim b'Beisai. They would be for 1 month at a time at Levana cutting down trees, and 2 months in his house. Some of the Mephoshim on the Pasuk actually explain that Bevesai means that Shlomo would be entertaining them in the palace for 2 months, but the Gemara is taking it over here, and so does some of the Mephoshim, that it means they would be each one in his house for 2 months. So therefore, Rabbi Yochanan says that's the same kind of schedule that a Talmid Chacham should be following. Unless if we're sure that his wife doesn't mind, then that's different. Tosfos actually points out that, later on in the Perek, we have the example of Rabbi Akiva, who was away for 24 years. We have several other Chachamim we're going to have later on in the Perek who were away for years and years. So how does that not contradict all of this over here? Tosfos says the difference is, there it wasn't a matter of the husband convincing his wife to go. Adarabba, she's happy for him to go. We see that Rachel tells him, go off to the Beis Medrash, and we have in the story over there where when he comes home after 12 years, she says, I wish he'd be away for another 12 years. So over here, we're talking about where she hasn't bought into it and the husband has to convince her, then we're saying that he can be away for only a month, at a time. Then Tosfos brings a different explanation that when the Gemara is asking Urcha de Milsa Kama, is in fact not asking about a Talmid Chacham, but rather a regular worker. Suppose a regular worker wants to be away without his wife's permission. How long can he be away for without it being that he's impinging on her oina? And the answer is 1 month here, 1 month there, or 1 month here, 2 months there, as the case may be. Okay, the question is, Rav Nami my time alay omamehahi. So why doesn't Rav use the pasuk that Rabbi Yochanan is quoting, where we see that Shlomo's labor force was taka away for 1 month and then home for 2 months? The answer is, he says, "Shiny binyan beis mikdash de'efshar de'echedim," because the difference is the building of this mikdash could be accomplished by other people. You don't need davka this particular worker to go to Levon and to chop down trees. There are plenty of others who could do the same thing, as opposed to every Talmid Chacham is unique. So therefore, Rav says you can't make him stay for 2 months away at home, not going to the Beis Medrash. Why doesn't Rabbi Yochanan use Rav's pasuk? And the answer is Shiny Hasim de'Islay Harvacha. The difference is when you're working for the king, when they're working as part of David's ministry over there, they're paid very well for it. So therefore, the wife might be willing to my husband will be away for only a month, and then he's going to be away for a month, and then he's going to be home for only a month, and so forth. At least we're making a nice amount of money out of it. So therefore, she might be more willing to go along with such a thing, and therefore you can't prove from that for a Talmid Chacham, where she may not necessarily feel that she's getting so much benefit out of it. Later on in the Perek, by the way, it talks about that a woman might actually rather have less income. We'll learn about it tomorrow or afterwards, Vez Hashem, that a woman might actually prefer to have less income and have her husband home more. Tosfos points out over there, okay, but here you're talking about working for the king. It's not just a little extra income. We're talking about a huge increase in their income. So that she might be more willing to go along with. Having mentioned one machloikas of Rav and Rabbi Yochanan, how to douse in Pesukim, so now the Gemara brings another one. Omer Rav, anocha sheveres chatzi gufo shel adam. A sigh, a krecht, breaks half of a person's body. Shenema, as we find a pasuk in Yechezkel, va'ata ben adam he'onach, Hashem tells Yechezkel, you ben adam sigh. The context is that Hashem is telling him the Beis Hamikdash is soon going to be destroyed. So now you should be sighing and mourning for it even in advance. The shivrin masnayim, with breaking of the loins, like as if your body is breaking in half, because the loins, after all, there's the waist is in the middle of the body, over mirirus, and with bitterness, te'onah, you should sigh. So we see, says Rab, that the sighing is breaking his masnayim, which are in the middle of his body. Rabbi Yochanan says it'll actually affect his entire body. Shenema, because the next pasuk continues. People are going to ask you, Yechezkel, what are you crouching about? And you should say, El Shmua Kiva, because of the news when it's going to come, namely that this mikdash was destroyed. V'nomis kolev, and every heart will melt. V'rofu choyodayim, and all hands will be weak. V'chiasacho ruach, and every spirit will feel weak. And all knees will be flowing like water. In other words, people's knees are going to be shaking and trembling like flowing water and sweating. So in other words, we see that the pasuk is mentioning various parts of the body, the lev, the adayim, so we see it affects the whole body. Well, Rabbi Yochanan Nami Hoksib the Shivan Masnaim. So what is Rabbi Yochanan doing with the first pasuk that mentions only the loins, the hips? But the answer is he says, fine, it means the effect of it starts from there, but then eventually it extends to the whole body. What about Rav Nami Oksiv Namas Kolei V'Rofa Cholidayim V'Chiyasa Choruah? What does Rav do with the second pasuk? And the answer is Chayni Shmur, the Beis Mikdash to Tekifah Tova. Because the difference is the news about the Beis Mikdash being destroyed is very, very harsh, terrible news, so that even Rav agrees that kind of news would break a person's whole body. Now, Tosfos points out these tzukim are back-to-back, and both of them are talking about the Beis Hamikdash. So what do you mean that Rav is saying there's a difference between other kinds of news and the news about the Beis Hamikdash being destroyed? So he says, because the difference is, the psukim over here are talking about before the Churban. So Yechezkel was saying, Hashem is telling Yechezkel, and Yechezkel is telling the Jewish people, I'm krechting now in advance that the Beis Hamikdash is going to be destroyed if people don't do tshuva. But now, you, all of you, when you hear the actual news, right now, you're maybe not receptive. We find throughout the first half of Sefer Yechezkel that the people weren't always so receptive to his nevuos. But now, he says, when it actually happens, then all of you are going to be krechting to such a degree that it will break your whole body. So therefore, again, Rav can say that that's different than a regular kind, and even Yechezkel's beforehand, which would only break half his body. There is an interesting explanation about this. From the Nesivos. He says like this. The machlokas between them is basically, so you have, there can be a person who's facing a possibility of something very bad happening. It might happen, it might not happen. So Rav is saying it breaks half his body in the sense, in other words, we're talking about something which, as we're saying, it's not something as serious as the destruction of this mikdash. It's something that may happen, may not. So let him krechts and let him daven and sigh in that way. Let him sigh, and that way people will see what's going on with him, and they'll have rachmonis and daven on his behalf that it shouldn't happen. But Rav is saying, basically, once it already happened, then already it's too late. Then at that point, don't be krechting. Then at that point, accept the Eibishter's din with Ava, because you don't complain about... In other words, before that also, you have to accept it by Ava, but before that, at least you can be davening for it. But once it's pretty much inevitable, then don't be krechting about it, because it's not going to look like you're complaining about what the Eibishter's doing. Just accept it by Ava. Whereas Rabbi Yechanan is saying, no, even kol gufo shel adam, even you're talking about something that actually is inevitably going to happen and it's going to affect the person's whole metzius, nevertheless, you should still be krechting and there's still time to daven, and even though it's going to happen, the Eibishter can still mitigate it, and then people's tefillos can still have an effect and so forth. So the Gemara tells, how one time a Jew and a Goy were walking on the road together. And the Jew was walking faster, and in fact, by the way, in Halacha, you're not supposed to, in Halacha, really, he wasn't necessarily doing the right thing. The Gemara mentions in Avodah Zarah that you're walking together with a goy, you shouldn't necessarily be walking in front, because he could stab you in the back or something, Rahman al-Aslan, but in this case, the Yid was walking very fast. Lo imsi akum sagri b'hadi Yisrael. So the goy wasn't able to keep up with walking with the Jew. So he wants to slow him down. So he mentioned to the Jew about the churban. Nogid v'itnach. The Yid sighed and krechts. By the way, you can see the level that this Yid was on. He's an anonymous Yid over here. We don't know anything else about him, but you can see that still you mentioned him in the Beis Mikdash and the Churban Abayis, and it has such a powerful effect on him. Halavai, we were on that level. Anyway, even so, the Goy couldn't keep up with him. The Yid was still walking fast. So the Goy tells him, Lo Yamritu, don't you Jews say, Anocha Sheveres Chatzi Gufa Shel Adam, that sighing breaks half of a person's body? And Marsha points out, apparently the Goy did not know the other half of the statement that we just said, that the Churban is different and it might even break a person's entire body. But he's saying, at least it should break half your body. Why isn't it slowing you down? Amalei, so the Yid answers him, Hani Mili Milsechadda. That's true when it's a new disaster that just happened, and a person is sighing about it, then yeah, it breaks his body. But this kind of thing, Dashinanba, we're used to it already, because, look, I mean, the Churban happened quite some time ago. We even have an Aloha to a certain extent. We say about the Avelus for the Churban, we call it Avelus Yushana, which has certain implications in Halacha as far as the Alochas of Tisha B'Av. So we're already used to it, Loi, so even though, yes, we still krechts about it, but it doesn't affect us so deeply as to break our body. Da Amri Inshi, it's like people say, De Malpatachli, a woman who, Rahman al-Tzman, is used to miscarrying children, Loi Bahasa, she's not shocked when she loses another one, because unfortunately she's used to it already. So the Yid says we're in the same situation. Okay, the Mishnah had mentioned types of workers, as far as the different types of people, how often their owner is supposed to be. So the Mishnah said, "Hatayolin b'chol yoyim." Tayolin, which we're going to define now, what that is, their expected owner is every day. So my tayolin, what is the definition of tayolin? Omer Rava, b'nei pirki. So Rava says these are people who talmidim, where their Rav lives in their city, and they're able to go to the yeshiva. They're like day students in the yeshiva. In other words, they're not students who board in the yeshiva because they're out of town. They're rather the talmidim who learn in the local yeshiva in town, and they go home and sleep every night. So therefore, so Rava is saying they're the ones, they're the tayolin, since they're sleeping at home every night, then therefore they're oiners every night, as opposed to if they were learning out of town. Amalahu Abaya, but Abaya says, how could you say that's the meaning of it? Man dichtiv bahu, consider, the Pasuk says about Tamir Chachamim, the Pasuk is speaking to people who do other kinds of work, Shav lachem mashkimekum, it's useless for you who wake up, who get up early in the morning, to do your work, ma'achre sheves, and stay up late, uichle lechem ha'atzavim, who are eating the bread, who are eating the food of difficulty and of toil. So you're working so hard, you're getting up early, you're staying up late, doing your work, and then you think that's how you're that's what you need for your parnasa. So you're putting in tremendous effort. You should know, Ken Yitin Lididoi Shena, Hashem will give the same kind of thing, the same kind of atzlocha to Yididoi Shena. Now, the simple meaning of Yedidoi means his friend, and the Mefarshim on the Pasuk explain that it means something like Hashem is saying that, listen, if you're a friend of Hashem, if you're close to Hashem, then Hashem will give you the same thing without all that tremendous tircha. You won't have to put in as much effort into your parnasa. But here, the Gemara is dashing, V'omer Rav Yitzchok, Eilun Sheisein Shatamir Chachamim, the Pasuk is referring, the last words in the Pasuk are referring to the wives of Tamir Chachamim, Sheminadidoi Shena Beinayim Ba'olam Azeh, they banish sleep from their eyes in this world, in other words, Yedidoi, Wadarshin, Meloshin, Menadid, because they wait up for their husbands, are in the Beis Medrash, and they're sitting there late, and they're sitting there and learning late. And those women are earning a place in Olam Haba because of the fact that they're loyally staying up for their husbands and waiting. So we see that the Chachamim, yes, they're day Talmidim, but they don't just leave the Beis Medrash as it gets dark. They're in the Beis Medrash long after it gets dark. So what are you telling me, says Abaya, that they have time for Oina every night? Marsha brings over here, you know, we have in a siyum on a masechta, or whatever we say, the expression onu mashkimim v'heim mashkimim, onu rotzim v'heim rotzim. So the people who are working, they're waking up early, they're mashkimim, and they're staying late. But it's still shav because when Marsha says, when it says oichle lechem ha'atzavim, besides for the simple meaning that means that they're earning their parnasa with tremendous toil and tremendous hardship, it also is a hint that they're not able to keep their oina in the proper way. Lechem is a euphemism for a man's wife, as we find by Potiphar with Yosef, ki ma lechem ashuhu oichel. So therefore, so they end up with lechem hatzav, and they end up with they're not able to have their lechem in its appropriate time. So, and the same way, we're saying kein yitin lidida shena, it's the same thing with Shemir HaChamim, because they stay out so late learning that they don't have time for oina in its time either. Nevertheless, we're saying, so you would think, in that case, well then in that case, I'm a worker, then I'm no worse off than the Talmud Chacham. No, we're telling them it's still shav. It's still, you're losing out because, like this, the Talmud Chachamim and their wives are gaining chaya olam haba from what they're doing, whereas you are not, necessarily. Anyway, the point is, with all of this, then that the point is that you can't say that these tayolim means the Talmud Chachamim who are sleeping at home. Now, to be sure, Tosfos says the word tayolim could mean, the word tayolim comes from the word tula in Aramaic, which means the shadow. So it means they're able to sleep every night under the shadow of their own roof. Nevertheless, though, Abaye is saying they're so fatigued in learning Torah and they put so much time into it. And Tosfos says, of necessity, the pasuk has to be talking about the menachem who are learning in town. Because if they're learning out of town, there's no reason for their wives to stay up late. They know their husbands are not coming home in the middle of the night. So necessarily, we're talking about the ones who are learning in town, but we see they're out late learning. So how would you think they have time? How would you think they have time for oina? Ella, Omar Abaye kidir Rav. So rather, Abaye says you have to define the word tayolim in the Mishnah the way that Rav defined it. Omar Rav, kigoin Rav Shmuel bar Shilas. An example of tayolim of our Mishnah would be Rav Shmuel bar Shilas. We learned a couple of days ago he was a Melamed. He was also one of the Amiroyim. So he is a Talmud Chacham, but he's a Melamed, and therefore his job is relatively easy. He doesn't teach at night after all. He eats his own food and drinks his own food. In other words, he's not having to he doesn't need to get from other people. He sleeps under the shadow of his mansion, of his house. And no government minister, like to collect taxes or whatever, ever comes by his door to collect taxes. Meaning, Maharsha explains like this. Sometimes you have other kinds of people who they're busy with their do business or whatever. And they ended up borrowing money from other people and they live beyond their means. Rav Shmuel bar Shilas is not like that. He lives within his means. He doesn't make money, very much money, maybe as a Malamed, but he lives very simply. So now what happens is people who borrow money and live beyond their means over time, first of all, they're not so at ease because eventually they have to pay back their debts. But more to the point also, because they live more grandly, therefore that attracts the attention of the government. The government thinks they're richer and therefore they assess them more taxes. Meanwhile, Rav Shmuel bar Shilas over here was saying, lived very simply. He never had to borrow from anybody. So therefore, the king's ministers, the king's tax collectors, or whatever, don't bother him because they figure he doesn't really have very much. So what are we going to get from him already? So therefore he's the kind of peaceful, he's the kind of person who lives at peace over there. Again, tayolim, meloshen tula. He lives in the shadow of his own house, and nobody ever bothers him, and therefore he has time for oina every night. In fact, Mephoshim points out another point as well. Unlike the other Talmud Chachamim, who we said stay up late learning, Rav Shmuel bar Shilas couldn't. It says in Shulchan Aruch, a Malamed is not allowed to stay up late, because he has to be at his best to teach the Talmidim the next day. So of necessity, therefore he's going to sleep at a decent hour, therefore he's got plenty of time for Oina every night. The Gemara continues, Ki also Ravin, Amar, when Ravin came from Eretz Yisrael, he said, here's another definition of Tayolin. Kugan Mefanki Demar Rava. For example, the pampered people in Eretz Yisrael. There are people over there who eat well and drink well, and they're healthy, and they have plenty of koyach. So in that case, the word Tayolin would be more related to the word Latayel, which means like to walk, like to saunter along, to walk very slowly, not like regular people who have to rush around. These people can saunter around and stroll around more carefree. So they're the kind who need an oina every night. So to give an example of these Mefanki Demar Rava, the people in the West, meaning in Eretz Yisrael, who eat and drink well and have lots of koyach, so the Gemara gives an example. Rabbi Yochanan have a kasolik bedarga. Rabbi Yochanan one time was climbing up a ladder. And Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi were holding on to him to help him up. If chesed darga tusei, all of a sudden a step of the ladder fell out from underneath him. Solik, he was still able to pull himself up. Vaskinu, and he pulled them up with him, so they don't all fall down. Amri le Rabbanan, so he was obviously very, very strong. Amri le Rabbanan, so the Chum asked Rabbi Yochanan, v'chim ha'achar dehochi, well, if you're so strong, lama le Mismache, then why are Rabbi Ami and Rabasi supporting you in the first place? You've got quite a bit of koyach. He tells him, well, if I use up all my strength now on climbing ladders and steps or whatever without support, what will I have left for my old age? In other words, I gotta preserve my strength now so I have more of it for when I get old. In fact, Rabbi Yochanan lived to be quite old. There's actually sources that say, there's actually one place, there's something I think from the times of the Gaonim, that says that Rabbi Yochanan lived to 400 years old. That may be a guzma, but we do know Rabbi Shmuel Gaon says that Rabbi Shmuel Gaon writes that he was Rosh Hashiva in Eretz Yisrael for 80 years, which would mean that he lived to well over 100. Some historians say maybe the word is supposed to be pay, it's supposed to be samach rather than pay, so it would be 60, but still he lived to quite an old age. Rodotus of the Shoenim explains, based on by putting together various details that we know about him, that it seems Rabbi Yochanan lived to about 110 years old, if not more. So he needed his strength factor because he did end up living quite long. Okay, the point is, in other words, he's an example of Mafanki Demarova. On the one hand, he's putting in tremendous effort and koyach into learning Torah. On the other hand, he is physically strong, as we see from the story. So he would be the kind of person, I guess we'll say, if he weren't a Talmid Chacham, then his owner would indeed be every night. Since he was, then okay, it would be every Friday night, like other Talmid Chachamim. Yom Yom Mashiach Gola, Ches Tevis. We started learning yesterday about the Rebbe was talking about that when it says the Jewish people have to do tshuva for Mashiach to come, it's not actually an absolute prerequisite. So yesterday we talked about, because every Yid does a hero tshuva sometimes. I heard a story in this connection some time back. I heard the story in connection with Aaron Leib Steinman, but I don't know if that's accurate, because I also heard the story in connection with the attacks on Simchas Torah, and Aaron Leib had passed away a few years before then. But anyway, there was a person whose son had gone off the derech, and he takes him to see Rabbi Aaron Leib, whoever it was, and at one point he asks him, during all these couple of years that you've been off the derech, did you ever have a hero tshuva? And the boy says yes. He asks him how much. He says, maybe, I don't know, 4 times during the last 2 years. How much each time? He says 10 minutes. Wow, 40, you had 40 minutes hero tshuva. Halavai I would have such. Halavai I would have hero tshuva for 40 minutes throughout that time. Okay, so now the second thing is, second reason that Eber gives is, nowadays, the people who aren't keeping, Jews who aren't keeping Torah and mitzvahs, are tinokos v'nishbu. They're anusim. Onus rachmana patre. The Torah paters such a person from punishment. In fact, by the way, the Rebbe doesn't mention it over here, but there are various achronim that talk about that even you could say, fine, a person never grew up with any knowledge of Yiddishkeit, you could say tinik shenishba. What about, for example, if he grew up, taka grew up frum and went off the derech? There is. I've seen something from Rav Kook on the subject. I've seen something from Rav Chaim Kanievsky on the subject that says that nevertheless, they are also considered tinik shenishbu. Because there's so much attractiveness of a goyish culture and a non-frum culture out there that you can't really hold them responsible for succumbing to it. Anyway, on the Mayasaben, yeah. So and then the Rebbe continues in the Sicha, and when those Tinokas Shenishba accomplish even one mitzvah, then it's tremendously precious by the Edishter. And in our generation, we see how tens of thousands of Tinokas Shenishba have tackled returned and are continuing to return to the way of Torah. This was actually, all of this was in the Sicha at the beginning of the first Gulf War, where, as everyone knows, there was a Rosh Hashiva at that time who was saying very harsh, terrible things against non-Frum Jews, and the Rebbe was screaming out against it in this whole Sicha, and these were among the points that Rebbe made at the time, yeah. Okay, continuing on halachas of things that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos that are not actual malachas. See, here's another one. You're not allowed to wait by the tchum until Shabbos ends. So suppose, for example, you have some place where you need to be after Shabbos that's outside the tchum. So you're going to walk until the end of the tchum or close to it, and then you're going to wait there until it gets dark, so that way you have a head start. Can't do that, because then since you're continuing Motzei Shabbos, then it's obvious you went there on Shabbos for that purpose. Now, that would only be if you're doing something for a purpose that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. Say, for example, you're going because you have to hire workers or pick fruit or things like that, where there's no heter to do such things on Shabbos. But say, for example, it was to go pick up your animal. Now, the fact is, if there were houses over there, you would be able to walk that distance. Bringing the animal itself, not carrying it, but we're talking about leading it, is not an Issur Shabbos. So therefore, so you would be, for another example, would be fruit that was already picked before Shabbos, which is not Muktzah, so then you would have been able to. Had there been Mechitzis, you would actually be able to carry it, so such things you're allowed to. Even you could have, for example, you could be going to a garden where you're going to pick fruit there, Motzei Shabbos, because it's not so obvious that you went there for that. People will say you went to your garden because you wanted to take a walk, or you're looking for something that's lost or whatever, and then once you were there, you decided to stay there till Shabbos is over and pick the fruit. Practically speaking, we who live in big cities, I don't know how often this kind of thing happens. I suppose you might have it if you're up in the country in a bungalow colony or something. It might be a more practical thing to be aware of.